Hey, Mark.
Yeah, Tim?
I got something I gotta say.
Well, tell me all about it.
Johnny's in the basement mixing up the medicine, and I'm on the pavement thinking about the government. The man in the trench coat badge out laid off says he got a bad cough and wants to get it paid off. Look out, kid, it's something you did. God knows when, but you're doing it again. You better duck down the alleyway looking for a new friend. A man in a coonskin cap and a pig pen. He wants $11 bills and you only got 10. Comes Fleetfoot, face full of black soot, talking at the heat, put plants in the bed, but the phone's tapped in. Anyway, Maggie says that many say they must bust an early mayor's orders from the DA. Look out, kid, no matter what you did, or walk on your tiptoes, don't try to know those. Better stay away from those that carry around the fire hose. Keep a clean nose and watch your plain clothes. You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. Get well, hang around the anchor well, ring the bell. Hard to tell if anything you're gonna sell. Try hard, get barred, get back, write braille, get jailed, jump bail. Join the army if you fail. Look out, kid, you're gonna get hit. But users, cheaters, six-time losers, or hang around the theaters. Girl by the whirlpool looking for a new fool. Don't follow leaders and watch your parking meters. Yeah. Keep warm, short pants, romance, learn to dance. Get dressed, get blessed, try to be a success. Please her, please him, buy gifts. Don't steal, don't lift. 20 years of schooling and they put you on a day shift. Look out, kid, you keep it all hid. Better jump down a manhole, light yourself a candle. Don't wear sandals, try to avoid a scandal. Don't want to be a bum, you better chew gum. The pump won't work because the vandals took the handle. You know what I mean, man?
I know exactly what you mean.
Tim O'Brien picking his way through the subterranean homesick blues to start us out for an hour of words and music. This week, the subterranean. What's underground and what's unseen in several senses. The geological, what's beneath our feet, and the psychological, what's hidden from our notice. Coming up, Judy Nelson tells us about learning a family secret. Jeremiah Lynn reports from Bemidji on the underground theater scene and a story from Matthew Miltich called A Clear Running Secret. My name is Michael Goldberg, here every week with Stay Human. I was thinking about what's unknown, unseen, underground, and that got me thinking about secrets, and I wrote this poem to the person who I know best in all the world. It's called The Mystery of You to Me. The mystery of you to me is not so different, maybe, than the secrets of each to any. Those strangers, what voices might they hear in the night? The thing they don't tell anyone, the memory that's theirs alone. Everyone is alone sometimes. What hidden lives are camouflaged, I wonder, under the fluorescent light at the big box? Or on the street, I nod, they look and look away. What's their hidden treasure, hidden shame? What webs of relations or wordless sensations that I would never guess? Each one a mystery to me. And you, who I imagine you to be and who you are, who and how even now so hand in glove remains the mystery of you to me. It's the Black Keys with Every Little Thing. Our first teller today is Sue Searing with a story from a long, long oral tradition, this one attributed to Aesop, the miser and his gold.
Once there was a miser who hoarded every gold coin that came his way. But then he became afraid that someone would break into his house and steal his coins. So he melted them all down into one big lump of gold, and he buried it in his backyard. He wasn't afraid that anyone would see him do this because there was a tall wall all around his property. But he missed fingering that gold every night, taking it out and counting it. So he often went during the day and sat next to the place that he had buried it. And every few days, the desire to touch his gold would just overwhelm him, and he would dig it up again and hold it and look at it, and then rebury it in the ground somewhere else in his property. And again, he was never afraid anyone would see him because of the tall walls. What he didn't notice was that his neighbor hired some workers to replace the roof on his house. And up there from that high vantage point, they could see down into his yard. And they noticed his odd behavior. And they saw him dig up that gold. And that night they came back with their ladders and they scaled the wall and they stole the gold. When the man came out the next day to see this empty hole, oh, he lamented so loudly. He tore his clothes, he tugged on his hair, he cried and wailed until his neighbors came running to see what was the matter. When he explained that his gold had been dug up and stolen, they said, "Oh, we're so sorry. You must have been saving it to buy something very special." "Buy something," he said. "What? No, never. I wouldn't ever spend my gold." That's when a neighbor looked around and picked up a big rock and handed it to him. "Here," he said, "bury this in the ground. It'll do you just as much good."
Thanks to storyteller Sue Searing. We're so accustomed to thinking of gold as a metaphor, buried treasure, but here in northern Minnesota, it couldn't be more literal. The precious metals, gold, nickel, copper, are under the ground, the third largest deposit known about in all the world. And there's plenty who covet it, are working hard every day toward the day they can start digging it up. We live in an age of giants, ravenous and destructive, walking the earth. The Chilean giant, Antofagasta, gulps down whole watersheds. The giant intimidates the locals, buys off the politicians so it can pull sulfide rock out of the ground, crush and process it to extract the treasure, which it takes away, leaving behind most of what's mined, the sulfide. Antofagasta plans to get as much of the sulfuric acid out of the sludge as they can. There's a market for that, too, and leave us with the rest. Don't worry, they say, nothing will go wrong. When the conversation turns to destruction and the value of the freshwater resource, the friends of the giant want to talk about the value of the nickel, copper, and gold. It's right there in the ground, and we use these metals. Look at your cell phone, and we have no choice but to get the treasure. Of course, it all depends on how you define treasure. A year ago, the U.S. Department of the Interior put a 20-year stop on any new mining of public land thousands of acres near Yellowstone National Park. Last spring, President Trump signed a public lands bill that includes that protection. Apparently, Yellowstone is more precious than gold. But the Boundary Waters? That's up for grabs. It's worth the risk, our elected leaders tell us. And they could be right. Apart from the destruction of habitat needed to build the mine and the tailings processing and the roads, but no poisoning of the water system, maybe not, for 10 or 20 or even 50 years. Who knows? Nobody knows, because this is an experiment that's never been done before. But it's worth the risk, we're told. The treasure is there for the taking, and the giant promises to be careful. In the storybooks, the giant is always brought down by one little guy who nobody else believes in or thinks much of. Some little guy outwits him, or even by accident wins against the giant, while all the townspeople, who are sensible, hide and let the giant take what it wants. But Antofagasta won't be stopped by any beanstalk jack. This time, enough townspeople would have to stand their ground if they want to protect the true treasure.
On my 2 feet, it's ooh-wee when I'm through the streets. The cuties say cute sneaks, and them shoes sweet when the dudes speak. Nothing under 100, stunting on them ain't nothing. I'm frontin', but oh, they love it. I'm ahead of my class and passing, got a passion for flashing, satisfactions in fashion. Yeah, homie, I'm a tag popper, making you sick, call a swag doctor. These threads is concealing my flaws, but I am fulfilled by applause. I guess pride is my idol now. What I'ma do when these items go out of style? This ain't treasure, it's trash. I know this pleasure won't last. I need that real.
Yeah. Baby, that ain't never gonna last. That's just fool's gold.
Yeah.
That ain't treasure, that's trash.
And I know it look nice. I know it look nice. But that's a rip-off. For that price, that ain't treasure, that's trash. 'Cause it ain't never gonna last.
I'm Michael Goldberg, today on Stay Human with Stories of the Subterranean. I've lived near Grand Rapids about 40 years, so as a newcomer, I don't see the town as clearly as my friend, the writer Matthew Miltich.
This is called A Clear Running Secret. Once upon a time, the Grand Rapids of the Mississippi River in northern Minnesota ran freely through the middle of what became the town where I was born, which bears its name, Grand Rapids. But the Mississippi is dammed at the site of the paper mill there in the middle of town, and dammed also a mile or two upstream from the mill. The rapids is tamed now, no longer grand, and I've joked sometimes that a more accurate name for our town might be Damned Rapids. Truly a small town when I was a kid, it's grown considerably since then. Our little village, whenever I was freed from the confines of school or church, was for me a kind of paradise. The city street just south of our house was then unpaved, a dirt road, and traffic in town was so light this hardly mattered. Our neighborhood on the north side was leafy and green in summer, its houses and yards interrupted here and there by vacant lots growing tall grass and cottontail rabbits. Four lakes, sparkling in summer, ice-covered in winter, lay within easy walking distance of our home, from which we, the kids in my family, frequently were commanded by our mother simply to go outside and play. Maybe organized activities for kids were part of some portion of the fabric of the town. I don't remember any, only that my two older sisters took dance lessons and piano. But for me, a boy, the outdoors, for as far as I could walk or run or bike, was wide open. The Mississippi, the principal geographic feature of the town, rapids tamed or not, ran deep and wide and dark and scary. Its north bank was fenced off and away from us, for some distance west of the paper mill dam, claimed by the mill for its wood yard. Flotillas of pulp logs floated in the river nearby, in the pool created by the dam. Floating logs held captive by boomers. Huge boom logs chained end to end to corral the flotilla beside the woodlot. All that floating pulpwood ready for the grinders in the mill. Sometimes in summer, we town boys walked the boomers, which sank and turned slimy and slippery under our bare feet. We strove to stay upright, but soon we lost our balance as the boom log twisted and submerged beneath us, and when we fell in, remembered the giant snapping turtles and soft shells and muskies and minks and muskrats that haunted the pulp logs. If the mill cops caught sight of us, we hid in the water among the floating logs or scrambled back to the riverbank to run for it. Same thing when we climbed the fence and got into the woodlot. If the mill cops spotted us, we hid or ran, and we never got caught. If the rapids was no longer so grand, still I held the river itself in both awe and affection. But when I was a small boy, my real and true love, closer to my house and running perfectly clear, safer, more approachable, and more intimate than the big river, was Hale Creek, which flowed from spring-fed Hale Lake a few blocks west of home to stream south and east through town, then to join the Mississippi several hundred yards downstream from the paper mill dam. The creek ran between my house and Central School, the public elementary school about five blocks away, where I attended kindergarten, and when for first grade I started fall classes at the brand new Roman Catholic parochial school, three blocks south of our house, the creek lay just halfway between home and school. I couldn't keep away from that creek, and I couldn't keep out of it. School, confinement indoors, the company of a bunch of little strangers of my own age, the authority of an adult to whom I had no other relation than her apparently unlimited dominion over my minor little self for all the hours, days, weeks, years I was held captive in the institutions in which my formal education first was thrust upon me. These I endured as well as I could, as I yearned to be outdoors, but the creek, oh, there I lived. There I felt the pulse of life in the uncounted creatures I met there, alive in the running water and amidst the tall grasses along the wet, lovely margins of that pristine little brook, which was to me a stream of life. Oh, I tell you truly, I loved it. Somehow, I couldn't quite pay attention in school, couldn't hold my focus on the flood of words washing over the class from the front of the schoolroom. Instead, I dreamed of being outside and away. From the first grade forward, I was accused by my teachers and by the principal at St. Joe's Elementary of being a dreamer, the word itself an indictment. Sometimes I imagined I had an exact double who sat in my desk in the classroom, keeping my place in school so no one would know I was away, as my real self studied the creek and the marsh it spread into on the west side of the north-going state highway near our house, and explored the deep ravines and shallow valleys along the creek's watercourse through our town, and there I caught and let go frogs and turtles and other small creatures. I waded the stream to investigate spawning northern pike, or checked up on jellied masses of frogs' eggs to see how near they were to turning into tadpoles. It didn't occur to me until much later in my life that, in a way, that's what was happening. I mean, my body was in the classroom, but I was gone. I was elsewhere. During summer, glorious summer, which in those days seemed nearly infinite, I was free and spent every day outside. During my early years, people of modest means could own summer cabins on northern Minnesota lakes. My maternal grandmother, a widow and poor, a schoolteacher, owned a primitive lake cabin. My paternal grandfather, an immigrant and poor, an iron miner, owned a somewhat more primitive cabin on Lake 14. My father, a musician and proprietor of a small business, more prosperous than his own folks and his mother-in-law, together with six of his pals, owned a camp on Cutfoot Sioux Lake. During high summer, between visiting those cabins and playing in or along the lakes right in my hometown, I was in a lake, on a lake, or beside a lake all summer long. These were summer loves, intoxicating, but the creek was my steady, and during the interminable seeming school year, lying so handy to home, it gave to me not only the joys of freedom and fascination, but clues, especially during springs and early summers, to the mysteries of reproduction about which my curiosity burned. The most fecund section of Hale Creek lay on the upstream side of the state highway that led away to the north on the far side of our block. In the marsh, a myriad of creatures courted and mated and conceived and gestated or incubated and hatched or morphed or gave birth. The whole subject of sexual reproduction, taboo in school and church, revealed itself in profuse and endless demonstration in the marsh, or as we called it then, the swamp. So many days I returned from school late, wet and muddy, my good shoes soaked and ruined, my school clothes bespattered. Finally, my parents forbid me to set foot in that marsh. Orders from them whom I loved, which I found myself unable to obey, no matter the consequences. But my hometown itself did what my parents and my school could not. It took my creek away from me. Little by little, a section of its waterway here and another section there, my village buried Hale Creek. Where once it ran free and clear, the stream was channeled into concrete culverts and buried beneath the town. The creek began to disappear, as I remember now, at about the same rate as my childhood left me. Where once the marsh gave birth to uncounted live creatures, houses came to stand alongside the highway. The creek valleys and ravines through which my lovely brook flowed were backfilled and became building lots, and then came new houses, not one of which, to my eyes, could match the creek for beauty and fitness. By the time I was grown and left to begin my adult life in the larger world, but for a couple of tiny segments of its original watercourse, the creek ran invisibly and secretly under the town, as it does today. Could my people not see Hale Creek as I saw it, lovely and worthy and fitting, a part of the geography of the town to be celebrated instead of buried? Will it always be so?
That's Matthew Miltich with A Clear Running Secret, a new story from him, heard for the first time here on Stay Human. And here's a new release from Michael Rossetto, 3 on the 5.
Some are dead and some are living. There is no one compares with you, and these memories lose their meaning when I think of love as something new. Though I know I'll never lose affection for people and things that went before, and I know I'll often stop and think about them in my life. I love you. That went before, and I know I'll often stop and think about them in my life. I love you more.
Diane Krall on your Northern Community Radio Service, KAXE, KBXE, streaming at KAXE.org. I'm Michael Goldberg, and I want to thank all the listeners whose membership contributions make it possible to create independent radio that listens to its listeners and celebrates the life of Northern Minnesota. This and other local programs also receive support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today on Stay Human, some stories about the subterranean, what's hidden. Coming up, we'll have Jeremiah Lind with a Q report, all the secrets to having a secret society. Our next teller is Judy Nelson, who discovered a family secret.
It was a cold October morning, one of my first days back in Grand Rapids after a few years living in Duluth. Half-empty boxes were strewn around the kitchen. I had been unpacking, listening to KAXE, when I heard a lovely poem about a loon on a lake. I barely heard the author's name, Vern Thompson. My outstretched arm stopped in midair, my hand holding cereal bowls. Vern Thompson? My deceased uncle's name was Vern Thompson. Could this be his poem? Nah, couldn't be. Nobody in the family ever mentioned he was a poet. But he was an English teacher at the community college for years before he passed. He had been a role model for me to be a teacher. Could this be his poem? Wasn't that Sand Lake he lived on? Uncle Vern was a secretive guy. He was sensitive and smart, nerdy and good-looking. He was the youngest of the four Thompson kids, my mom Luella being the oldest. Raised in hardscrabble, bushy, northwestern Minnesota on a farm not good for much, life was tough. There were few educational opportunities. My mom went no further than eighth grade. My grandparents had to sell a cow to buy her a confirmation dress. She escaped the farm to marry my dad during wartime. The two middle Thompson boys fled the farm for the army. But Vern was different. He was determined to go to high school. So he did, making it into town to school by whatever means it took, walking when necessary. In a home where his parents dueled it out in German and Norwegian, my grandfather turning up the radio when Grandma would admonish him, "Ach, Thomas, the cows are waiting." It seems logical to me now that Vern would learn early on to make sense of words with their power and secrets. Imagine a young boy of 15 juggling farm work and school studies and blizzards with parents who didn't understand much of Vern's schoolwork. Vern was the only sibling at home then, his dad Thomas, already elderly, being 18 years older than Vern's mom Dorothy. Life took a toll on Vern. The family began to notice that things weren't right. Even I noticed, though I was about 8 at the time. I recall waking in the night when visiting at Grandma's, looking out the upstairs window to see Vern running circles around the yard light, pat, 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 his dark hair shining, his glasses reflecting like headlights. What was he doing out there? So he can sleep, my mom explained. My memory jumps forward to images of tall buildings viewed from the back car seat window as Dad drove in Minneapolis. I had not ever been in a city before. It seemed like another world so far from the flatness of farm fields. Vern was in the hospital, Mother said. He had to stay until he got better. As a kid, I only knew to feel sad, yet I knew better than to ask for details. Somehow, I connected Vern's illness to his footsteps around the yard light so strange, pat, 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 pat. Years later, I was told that at 15, Vern had suffered a nervous breakdown, as they called mental illness then. Mother said that Vern stayed in the hospital for a year, from at the end of his sophomore year of high school onward, missing all of his junior year. He came home then, back to the farm. Nobody knew how things would go. Mother told me in hushed tones that Vern had endured something terrible called shock treatments. I had no idea what that meant, but Mother was crying, so it was something bad. Defying all the odds, Uncle Vern's strength would speak for itself. He amazed everyone when he combined his junior and senior years of school, graduating on schedule with his class. What's more, he graduated as valedictorian. I remember wondering how someone could be that smart. Vern's recovery is still a highlight of hope for me, even all these years later. Having battled my own bouts of depression when the world has turned upside down after a divorce or a death, I know how hard life can be. I have learned to keep secrets, too. Sometimes it's how we survive. Vern went on to college at Mayville State, followed by a few years teaching high school. He married. June and he adopted 2 children, and Vern enjoyed a long career in the Minnesota Community College system, teaching English. After retirement, he moved to Park Rapids, to a lovely home on a lake with loons. Sand Lake. Yes, the little sand lake of the loon poem. It was Vern, my Uncle Vern, who wrote the poem that stopped me in my tracks. He was already gone then, from lung cancer, although I realize he's not really gone. His words live on. His illness was never spoken about, ever, at any family gathering. Often, Vern and June didn't attend. I imagine how alone he must have felt at times, those times when he turned to writing, making sense of a sometimes cruel world by weaving together beautiful words. A few emails was all it took to connect the dots, first to KAXE, then to the volunteer host who read the poem. He had a place on Little Sand Lake, but had never met my Uncle Vern, though he knew of the poem, thought it lovely enough to read on the air. I traced him to Prescott, Arizona. In turn, he connected me to the Jack Pine Writers Group in Park Rapids, where I discovered many of Vern's poems and writings, published in their annual books. Vern's work had received first place several times. I ordered all the books from the archive, sharing Vern's writing with my own children. Oh, how my mother and all our family would have loved to have had the knowledge of Vern's genius as a writer, to hug him and tell him how proud we were. His brothers never knew either, and now they are gone. But wait. I know firsthand how critical words from a loved one can rip a deep wound in a fragile psyche. One year, I spent a long time on a Christmas letter, a true story about a chickadee, complete with a whimsical drawing. On the phone, I asked my mom, "Mom, how did you like my chickadee story?" There was a pause, and then Mom said, "Well, it sure was long." So who knows how she might have reacted to her baby brother's writing. Maybe Uncle Vern was the savvy one, keeping his writing secured against the critical eyes of family, only sharing with trusted colleagues who were themselves writers. I got in touch with Vern's widow, June. I was so excited to tell her the miraculous story of how I discovered Uncle Vern's loon poem, asking her to please forward some of Vern's work to me. By then, she had moved away from Little Sand Lake to a condo in the cities. I anticipated she would send something. "No," June replied with one of those tiny thank you cards, so I knew immediately she had not sent any of his writing. She graciously thanked me for stopping in to see her after Vern passed, but she did not mention a thing about his writing or my request for his writing. I understand the secrecy of writers. Many famous writers tell us to never, ever share our writing with family or friends. One has to be so careful, they caution us. Writers are a fragile sort. Vern was fragile like that. One has only to read his poems to feel his sensitivity. It's what makes his writing so damn good. So maybe Vern destroyed his writing when he got sick. Maybe he swore June to secrecy. Maybe June had no idea and was embarrassed to admit that. Maybe, worst of all scenarios, she wasn't interested. Nonetheless, I like to think I have inherited some of Vern's grit and determination. It's what commits me to carry on his writing legacy, sharing his Little Sand poem once again on the airwaves of KAXE, coming full circle, as they say. And if you are tuned in, Uncle Vern, on this airwave or through some other blue shifting light, please know you still inspire me, will always inspire me, and I thank you.
That's Judy Nelson. And here's the poem by her uncle, "To the Last Loon on Little Sand Lake" by Vern Thompson. So here we are, drifting side by side on the quiet evening water, watching the lake turn red and the darkness finger out from the pines and spruce along the west shore. We are an odd pair, you an upstart not yet in full plumage, and I an old geezer long past his prime. It's late. Your season here is over. The lakeshore is drawn in upon itself, boat lifts and docks piled well above the waterline, the laughter of children gone, the lake waits almost breathless to close over. You are the last. I have watched you, alone and silent now, having no one to call to. Others of your breed left weeks ago, obeying their primal call to flee before the gales of winter. So, too, it is with many of my neighbors. Each night I see fewer lights across the lake. We're getting out on Tuesday, one told me. We're going to drive straight through. I can picture them, fleeing through the night to a light at last among their own kind, to sit in the sun in front of their RV and celebrate their escape. I wish them well. But with you, my young friend, this is serious business. You have to leave or you will die. Ice has glazed the rocks along the shore. Soon it will creep out after you. You can't suddenly explode from the water, taking your cue from the mallards in the bay. You need a clear runway to churn and flap and pound before the water releases you to stagger into flight. Are you still here because you are not fledged enough to fly? Or is it some perverse urge to take your chances as long as possible? When your parents left, did you, like some balky adolescent in an avian airport, insist on a later flight? Or did you want to see the last of the birch and maple leaves burnish the water, or the sedges and bulrushes laced with frost each morning? I can understand that kind of wanting. The other morning, when you slipped, phantom-like, out of the clinging fog toward my boat, we shared one suspended moment as if we were the last waifs in a spirit world. But aesthetics must give way to reality. That is the lesson to be learned here, perhaps, sadly, the only one. My neighbor was right when he said, you gotta know when to haul ass out of here. So listen up, kid. Life does not give you unlimited choices. I slap the water with my oar as I yell, but you don't even flinch. You just cock your head and, I swear, faintly smirk. You have dodged too many water skiers and jet skiers to be impressed by a flailing old codger yelling nonsense. I am going home. I am going to build a fire and share a glass of wine with my wife as the night gathers in around us, and hope that in the morning you'll be gone. Godspeed. Thanks to volunteer producer Peter Pearson, who years ago read that poem by Vern Thompson when Vern's niece, Judy Nelson, just happened to be listening to Northern Community Radio, connecting you to Northern Minnesota. We'll be right back. Rodrigo y Gabriela on Northern Community Radio. For this hour, we have one more kind of underground to consider. This one from Jeremiah Lind with his Q report.
6/21/2035. Dearest active agents, this year is my last birthday. As the time phone has ordained, I will be leaving this timeline on New Year's. It's been a good run, but in the end, our efforts in building and maintaining a sustainable arts force relies on you, the participants, the agents, the weird. On this day, I wish to share the story of how we arrived here, when it all began and how it all shook out. More importantly, I want to give you a gift, the secret keys to eternal and unending joy and peace as provided by a secret society. It is the way out of this place, this horrible place in which we have found ourselves. But before I can articulate the escape plan, I must tell you about the Guild. It begins with five swords people. In the winter of 2006, the Shadow Council authorized the formation of the Bemidji Swashbucklers Guild, aka the BSG, as a drunken dare to file paperwork. It was a spring and summer of unending swordplay and ninja swashbuckling operations. We were young then, filled with the vitality and anger that comes of having our youth robbed from you by the churning and unending chaos of war. It was subsequently incorporated in the state of Minnesota as a 501c3 nonprofit educational secret society. Although broad in initial mission, under my extremely secretive leadership, it was organized as a last line of defense by artists unified for liberty, justice, and equality. Operations would have a specific focus on supporting and assisting the arts, humanities, and peace through education, advocacy, and clandestine sword action. Paperwork would be avoided at all costs. Membership in the BSG is always and forever free. Recruitment occurs through a unicellular double blind that ensures that neither the agents nor the Shadow Council themselves are aware of any coherent plans. The key to operating in secret and underground is making sure that no one knows what's going on. Two may keep a secret when one is away. Wilbur Shakespeare, King Ugly V. All semi-public disseminations are provided via a secret internet blog. Notes from the Apocalypse connected with time phone protocols on March 31st, 2006. As a broadcast, it originates from deep underground, a place where the bombs and radiation could not reign. It remains underground, on the internet, as the least monetized literary platform in known existence. It disseminates a broad pastiche of secret arts events, failed misadventures, and gonzo designs, primarily in the form of rambling, overwordy prose, collected in massive run-on sentences. It is also a burning storage hole, lit as a smoke signal to the Google mainframe and AI. Perhaps the cost of securing gonzotheater.com has come at too great a cost. $30. Yet even now I can hear the money out there, somewhere, hiding, afraid to come too near, lest it lend any legitimacy to the ongoing lunacy. The less monetized, the more secret is the secret to societies. What is the secret to maintaining a secret society, you ask? Well, first let me say, great question. I appreciate your interest. Planning. You have to have a plan, however simple or complex, and the resources to action that plan. As an organization, the BSG is unicellular. This means that the smallest level of organization is a single person. That person could be you. It probably is, if you're hearing this weird stuff. Why else would you be listening along? Unless you were on board the whole weird ride. Beyond the obvious, your plan should maximize resources, create positive impacts, and build experience. Maximizing resources is vitally important to an operation of any size. Maybe you're mounting a production of Julius Caesar and donating all profits to the needy in the form of bottles of salad dressing. What are your resources? Is it $5,000? Let's say that it is, and you will just have to owe me the $5,000, okay? Great. I'll expect that check in the mail. Creating positive impacts are necessary to make anything successful. If you are not educating, advocating, or improving, then what is the point? Education is easy. Just ask any teacher. You just open up the mind and dump in information, like we're doing here. Advocacy is one of the most important tools of our modern age. You don't even have to march in the streets if you're too lazy. You just have to be willing to say something like, hey, this group deserves rights. Just like you people. Improvement is necessary to avoid regression. Maintaining the status quo is treading water in a boiling pot. Knit that on a pillow. I dare you. Progress is only made through advancing and promoting these efforts. Progress is what has lifted our lifestyles above that of nature, above the animals. Imagine if you didn't have this lavish society standing between you and packs of rabid dogs. Death by easily preventable diseases. Crippling ennui without constant audiovisual stimulation as a distraction from our brief and horrifying lives. All of this to suggest that the master plan must incorporate these principles, but every subplan seeks out to feature at least one of these components, to avoid staging Showboat with an entirely white cast, only to lose $20,000, as well as the respect of theater critics everywhere. Why a secret society? Many reasons. No need for a marketing department. No need for paperwork. Paperwork is the enemy. With all of this in mind, move forward now into the bright new future, confident in your ability to disappear completely. One infinite love. Q.
Thanks to Jeremiah Lind and to Judy Nelson, Matthew Miltich, and Sue Searing for joining me in this week's Theater of the Mind. I'm Michael Goldberg with Stay Human. Coming up at 6 o'clock, Jazz on America Avenue. We'll go out today with the Velvet Underground.
Now Okay, one of my all-time favorites there, Velvet Underground. Yes, thank you for playing that. You're tuned to, listening to 91.7 KXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, a local independent member-supported media in northern Minnesota, operating transitors K210DR in Brainerd at 8.